Weekly update in a moment. I want to remind you that the Destiny Foundation and the Young Israel of Flatbush present a conversation with Rabbi Beryl Wine and Malcolm Honlein. Ooh. I am not the only one who has the privilege of discussing things with Malcolm Honlein. In this case, on Wednesday night, it'll be Rabbi Beryl Wine. And that'll be at the Young Israel of Flatbush starting at 8 p.m., 1012 Avenue I in Brooklyn, New York. Information about all of this, you can go to jewishdestiny.com, you can go to rabbiwine.com, you can call for information at 1-800-499-9346. If I remember correctly from all of our 9 days programming, that is 1-800-499-WEIN. So Malcolm Honlein will be speaking with Rabbi Beryl Wine Wednesday night at the Young Israel of Flatbush. Malcolm Honlein is one lucky man. For a variety of reasons, most immediately because he is in the holy city of Jerusalem. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update from the holy city of Jerusalem. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Shalom, shalom.
I like that. You've adjusted well to that country, I see.
I adapt right away.
That's very nice. So many things to talk about. I want to start with this because last week we started in Israel, then eventually got to what's happening with Iran. Thought we'd do the opposite this time around. Iran, the U.S., and the European Union ended 2 days of high-level talks on Tehran's nuclear program on Monday with no immediate sign they had bridged gaps ahead of a November 24th deadline for an agreement. Now, I understand this is what's being reported in the press. Often you know the inside word about what to expect. Is there anything you could tell us 10 days away from this deadline?
Well, I think that the next deadline after the meetings in Oman on November 10th this week will be the November 18th session. I think it will be in Vienna. And my guess will be that they won't reach an accord. I think the gaps really are still too big, and the Iranians read the willingness of the West to negotiate as they have as perhaps an openness for them to be able to exploit, to gain more, that they will not give up enrichment, they will not give up and dismantle any of their facilities, which has to be seen as a primary requisite for a deal. So I think the likelihood is that we will see an extension of some sort. And as one official said, it could be 6 weeks to 6 months. But I think Congress will start moving on this, in terms of additional sanctions. There's a lot of anger because of the talk. It reports that the administration is looking to bypass Congress. While they can, and the president can act and has the power to take certain measures, I think it would be unwise to bypass Congress where the feeling is running very strong. The Russians even said that there may not be, it may not be possible to reach a deal, and the French foreign minister I saw said that there are key questions still to be resolved. So the overall atmosphere is one of, doubting and suspicion, and especially because the Iranians didn't let in the delegation from the IEA, and especially the American, who was a bomb expert. At least on five occasions, they kept refusing him access to come in entry and the delegation access to the facility. So as long as they continue to do that, you have no transparency. We don't certainly know what we don't know. We don't know what additional facilities, and even the facilities we know, we're not completely sure what is going on.
Is there anybody doing the bidding of people like you who are completely outraged by all these extensions? Is there any potent voice in the U.S. that's noteworthy, that is expressing their anger that these extensions are exactly the opposite of what needs to be done?
Well, I think that there are quite a few voices, even in the media, but especially people like Senator Menendez, Lindsey Graham, others who have been speaking out regularly. There are members of the House, Royce and Engel, and others who have been very vociferous at Deutsch. In fact, I would say across the board, both Republicans and Democrats in the House and in the Senate. And you know what? They just look at the facts. You look at, aside from the negotiations, which were supposed to be about dismantling Iran's nuclear program, and now seems to be about how long a breakout period it will take. But they look at what's happened in Yemen. They look at their role in Iraq. They look at their role in Syria, in Lebanon. It's destructive and it's instructive in the sense that the Iranians have now become determinant forces in those countries. At the same time, their human rights record is abysmal. They put out figures that there were already in the first half of 2014 over 411 executions. That means one every 3 hours, every 8 hours on average, 24/7 throughout the year. And it should be something that people should find so repulsive. And we look at how they are, and especially it has minorities from religious and ethnic groups, and they use both the physical torture, psychological torture, and they don't pay any price for it. Nobody holds them to account for it. The people in the region are very concerned. They're concerned by the letter the president sent, and that we understand there were four of them, responses by Khamenei that we don't know exactly, but it doesn't appear that he was very forthcoming. I think the president wanted to show that we've given them every opportunity to demonstrate that they really want to be a partner or really are prepared to take some steps. They are not, and they continue to support terrorism. They are working to advance some of the terrorist operations that we see in Syria, et cetera, and arming and training Shiite groups in Iraq who are more vicious even than al-Nusra and ISIS. So I think that the role they played now that was exposed as Iran itself admitted, of building Syrian missile production plants designed by Iran, missile training and production capabilities were taught to in Gaza and Hezbollah. These are not insignificant because you see the full picture.
You
danger posed by them.
Yeah, you said something very something interesting about the potential presidential response. You mentioned the letters, and obviously I can't imagine that too many people on the stronger side of the issue, the anti-Iran issue, were happy about that correspondence. But as much as you've just offered it as a possible analysis, do you think it's realistic that he was doing it as a final warning shot, really wanted to put out there the statement to Iran that this is it? You know, we've done everything. We've kept every end of the bargaining table on our end. And, you know, if things don't materialize the way they're supposed to by November the 24th or whatever, you know, shortly afterwards, that this is it, this is the final straw? Or is it very unlikely that that was the president's intention?
I don't know. I offer it as one of the interpretations that's possible about what the president intended. We don't know what was in the other four letters. But we know that in dealing with a country like Iran, and especially with the supreme leader, who then sees this perhaps as weakness, not as strength and determination, as the president may intend it to be, to send messages that, you know, if you want us to work with you on ISIS, and remember, what we're doing to ISIS is benefiting Iran. This is in their interest, given their alignments and their interests.
Is there any stable government that it doesn't benefit? When the U.S. goes up against ISIS and takes action, especially militarily, is there any, assuming for a moment that we call every established government in the Middle East a stable government, is there any government that doesn't benefit from that?
Yes, Assad.
Does not benefit from it?
The Assad regime, we are strengthening the hands of some of the other groups, the rebel groups, others. But we are also attacking, you know, the Khorasani, the others who are operating in these regions. What people point out is that we're not attacking the people Iran supports. Like, we do not attack Syrian troops and do anything to set back Assad. We certainly don't endanger the regime. The same thing is true in Iraq. So what they identified as their interest seems to be then outside of the target range.
What about this new unity? Is it official that ISIS and Al-Qaeda are now unified, have now merged together, are now going to stop fighting amongst themselves and go, you know, after their common enemies?
These are all temporary arrangements their basic interests are not the same. IS has already declared the caliphate, which does not include the Al-Qaeda. They were a breakaway. They were seen as even more extreme. But I think that the goals today, the leadership interests of the individuals, the egos, et cetera, it enables them to find a common ground in particular countries. It does not cross borders, so they may be working together in one country, but not working together in another. And I think that to read too much into any of these reports about alignments, they shift every day and in many ways, and I've talked about this on the air, about how all these rebel groups end up fighting each other,
right,
rather than fighting the Syrians. They fight Assad, the rebels versus ISIS or versus the al-Nusra, al-Qaeda groups. It's impossible to map it.
So if analysts declare that they are greater than the sum of their parts, that's a little bit overblown. There's so much inner strife. There's so much uncommon ground that it would be a rough analysis to try to prove that.
Absolutely, and there are some very interesting comments even from the leaders of these groups to this effect.
Yeah, interesting. So when they have these formal or somewhat informal ceremonies, to talk about and to establish their unity, it's simply what's best for this week for them.
Do you remember in the old days when Egypt and Libya, in Egypt and Syria, and then Libya and Syria, and everybody
right.
used to have these joint governments?
Right.
They would merge their governments. They would have the joint national unity, and et cetera. And that was always a sham. And I think that that's true here, too, that whatever front they put on, the rebels we see in Syria, for instance, are fighting on different fronts. You have rebels in the Golan. You have, in some cases, pushing al-Nusra out. In other cases, cooperating. You have different circumstances in virtually every place, and they are killing each other, too.
Yeah, unbelievable. Malcolm Honlein in Jerusalem. What do you think of the North Korean cooperation with the release of the detainees this week?
It's cost-free, virtually, for them. We don't know what they got for it. They certainly are looking for goodwill. It took the heat off of them for what they've done with the missiles, firing missiles, and their continued progress on their nuclear program. So I frankly don't see I'm glad they're home. I hope everybody who's being held hostage anywhere or held in prisons on these trumped up political charges will be released. But the fact is that they stood to gain, they hoped, in the international arena.
So these
paid no price.
And these gestures, in addition to the reputation, they do buy more time. There's a practical element to them.
Well, in certain senses, yes. I mean, it's very hard to go and attack or criticize when
right.
they just signed a deal, made a deal and released two people that you wanted to get free.
So the leader of North Korea is not as crazy as we think, is a shrewder political leader than we think. What's the...
We don't know what to think about him.
Right.
He disappeared for a long period.
Because the international media paints him as this crazy man, yet you're describing a situation where he's got some diplomatic savvy in him.
Well, we don't know if it's him or if it's other officials. We don't know the full role that he's playing. You know, he's reemerged in the last few days, but it's hard to assess. Overall, we know that North Korea's trajectory has not been a positive one.
Right. Malcolm Honlein with us from Jerusalem. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, and around the world on the web, jmtheam.org. Another week where we've seen attacks in Jerusalem. This time it's we've moved now from moving cars to knife attacks. Tel Aviv, the Gush area, you know what happened, and so many of our listeners, of course, are focused on the news and grieve together to an extent when these things occur. What do you say about the safety and security? We know what happened during the era of the bus bombings and how Israelis had to think twice about boarding buses and the apprehension that they would send their kids out to buses. What about now, standing at rail stations or at intersections and wondering what might happen?
Well, first of all, I think it's much quieter today. There were some incidents, including Hebron, and minor clashes. But first, let me just preface that I was at Shaar Tzedek today to visit some of the wounded, including Rabbi Glick, who happened to be sleeping, but I met his parents, whom I knew 40 years ago when they lived in Brooklyn, and his condition has improved. There's still danger, but he's much better, breathing on his own, and seems to be on the right way, and a Druze officer. And it's really remarkable how upbeat, how determined, wanting to get back to work, I mean, his brothers and as well. So it was very encouraging when you see the determination and the bravery of these people. And the and people are very determined here not to succumb to the pressure. And today the Temple Mount, our Arbaid, was open to all ages. They were expecting trouble, but I think overall it was pretty quiet. What is clear, and it came out of the meeting in Jordan last night with Secretary Kerry and the Prime Minister, King. I met the Prime Minister right before he went. You have extensive incitement that's ongoing from the PA, Palestinian Authority, including from Abbas, when he says you have to protect the Temple Mount by all means against the assault, painting Israelis and Jews as somehow violating it, always denigrating any claim of the Jews, and that means Christians as well, denying the biblical accounts and the existence of the temples. It has become a focal point in this, but Israel has said they're not going to change the status quo, and yet that doesn't help, and we see the Europeans and others all jumping on this, and they know that there's nothing more sensitive, the PA knows certainly, than claiming that there's something violative going on at the Temple Mount or at Har Bayis, and Abbas himself and Fatah are instigating this, as is Hamas, as is part of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamic movement, which is in Israel, the northern branch, which is very extreme and associated, as I pointed out, with the Muslim Brotherhood. So the number of attacks has shot up over recent months,
mm-hmm.
And you had 6 fatalities in a month. The government, I think, is determined not to let this happen. They cannot allow it to happen. Tourism suffers. People's lives suffer. Casts up all over the country, even though life in 99% of the country just goes on.
With that in mind, what is the security situation in places like Jerusalem and Tel Aviv? I mean, it has to be better than it was a couple of weeks ago, I hope.
You're asking a very good question.
I mean, it's very hard to secure a people against drive-over murderers.
And when you do a campaign where they talk about use vehicular attacks, and the world, and especially papers like the New York Times, then describes it, you know, Palestinians suspected. Well, who else? Doesn't mention, and in the accounts that I saw, talked about the sensitivity about the Temple Mount because of its sacredness to Muslims, and doesn't even mention the sacredness to Jews,
yep. As
I saw in another paper, and the instigation that goes on, and the refusal to hold Abbas to account. He keeps saying because he's better than the alternatives, people say. But there's got to come a point where he is held to account. Others who engage in this kind of incitement, I think Israel demonstrated incredible restraint, maybe too much after the attacks on the Mount of Olives on Har HaZeitim. All of these things have to be responded to right away because it just keeps spreading. They take advantage of any opportunity, and they are instigated to do it. And they can range around the country to have these incidents. Thank God, it is much calmer. You can walk the streets. There's no fear. There's no incidents, you know, that you encounter unless you're in a particular place where some event may have occurred.
Yeah, you mentioned incitement, and I got to give Miriam Wallach credit for pointing this out to me. If you look at these cartoons, the anti-Rabbi Glick cartoons, the cartoons that are encouraging more drive-over terrorist attacks, literally, showing in cartoon form Israelis lying at the side of the road with cars having just hit them. If you see, I don't know if you noticed this online, the Hug a Terrorist campaign, you know, which is absolutely outrageous. I mean, if you look at all this, it's not just incitement among those who are the most violent. It's these viral opinions and viral statements that they make, whether in real or cartoon form, that are just flying around the world, and people irresponsibly just keep spreading them all over the place.
And I tell people who show me them, I tell them, why are you even putting this up? Why are you downloading that kind of an image? And there's more, you know, when you look at what Jordan has done, Jordan has started to prosecute IS recruits and recruiters in Jordan. They're focusing on the 7,000 mosques in Jordan. They're telling them about the messages that they're allowed to use because they understand what the price you'll pay. They're fortifying their borders. They, you know, they are protected on Israel's border and by Israel as well. But they're looking to alliances with the U.S. and their air force has played a role in Iraq and elsewhere because it's in their self-interest. Nobody criticizes them for taking the steps necessary. Israel, which has demonstrated such an outreach to so many people in the region, to helping others in the region, for which they get no credit. The media so distorts and is so ready to jump, and the measures that are being adopted by European legislatures, the talk of increased boycotts that punish Palestinians because of and they're so stupid and counterproductive in what they're seeking to do or what they're trying, the message they're trying to communicate. And there has to be a clear message that we won't tolerate, that we have to stop it, because I'm telling you that it's spreading and we're going to see a bigger onslaught of these kind of campaigns against American companies who do business. And then you have the United Nations appointing a guy who has already to investigate Israel, who's already drawn the conclusion that we're not going to let him in, which is the right thing. Why should you allow guys, this team led by Shabas, when they've already said clearly what their conclusions are going to be?
Speaking of letting in, how many of the Americans who participate in the Hug a Terrorist campaign would allow those terrorists in their home tonight for dinner? I'd love to know.
Exactly.
I mean, people, the level of absurdity is just crazy. Yes, absurdity can be crazy, folks. Less than an hour. Malcolm, less than an hour till candle lighting for you. Will you be able to read Yisrael Hayom tonight when you relax in Jerusalem? Or have they banned that newspaper already from the State of Israel?
Well, it hasn't been banned. You know, there's legislation that is meant to address it. And this is a paper that Sheldon Adelson has underwritten. And so it's made available free. And because it is supportive of the government and Netanyahu, it became a target for others and obviously the other newspapers. So people seeking to take advantage of the opportunity to limit what others would say is an attack on free press. And if others have free magazines or free publications, are they going to be subjected to the same rules and restrictions that are being threatened here? And it doesn't matter whether you like the paper, you don't like it, you don't read it. But it is made available, as you know, free, and it's become the largest circulation paper, which is easy when you're free.
You have any idea what the Knesset vote was, even approximately? Like, was it an overwhelming victory for those who want to ban it?
It was a significant margin.
It's unbelievable. I mean, look, I know that you can't, we've discussed this a million times in the last 20 years, you can't apply American standards of freedom of speech, you know, to Europe and Israel. It's very different. As similar as it seems, we know it's very different. But still, this you know, your mouth had to have dropped when you heard about this legislative campaign to literally legislate out a free newspaper from Israeli society. You agree.
And the people who you would think would be the strongest voices to protect freedom of speech, freedom of access, are the ones who are most strongly advocating this move.
But we've seen this in Israel before, obviously in other forums, Knesset, etc. But I felt it was outrageous. I was surprised that media here didn't pick up more on it, you know, in 2014. I would think that they would think that it's a very significant, so maybe it will become more significant.
Well, they also don't want free newspapers to become popular in other societies. And
yeah, that's,
you know,
true.
So they probably aren't very sympathetic to the issue that's at stake here.
Yeah, that's true. Self-interest always.
But you know what? You see so many of the issues that get overlooked. You know, the human rights issues, almost no coverage. The beheadings that are taking place in Syria, in Lebanon, in other countries that they picked up from ISIS, because ISIS used it as a tremendous recruiting tool and gets 1,000 people a month. that they create a board of inquiry into Israel beyond the one of Shabbos, which is the United Nations. You have Human Rights Council one. You have UN headquarters looking at an independent board of inquiry looking into what's and what is look what we're doing in every other part. Look what every other country in the region is doing. Nobody gets investigated. They're killing people. Turkey, the rise of extremism in Turkey. And you know how much I've talked about Yemen, and now this week for the first time we actually saw people taking note of what took place. But you know that a Zim boat was attacked by pirates operating out of Somalia, which they've taken hundreds of ships because they go to the Bab al-Mandab, exactly what I said would be, you know, the straits, which now Iran is encroaching on through their control of the Houthis, who are expanding their influence in Yemen, and they control the Straits of Hormuz from the other side. And these pirates who come with arms and call for reinforcements because there were Israeli security on the boat, and they actually were able to get away and turn back the attack.
Hmm. And what was the reaction?
Oh, they're going to get their way for the next time. They don't care. There's so many ships going through there.
That's true.
But what I'm saying is that you read about how many ships are sitting in ports that have been lost or hijacked, and their crews sometimes held for months.
Right. Point well.
Not a word.
Point well taken. These are not. One cannot even use the excuse that they're isolated episodes, as you're saying. It's one after the other.
Exactly. Right. And you saw the case that came up that 200 veterans brought, the U.S. veterans, about the money that was transferred through Barclays, HSBC, Credit Suisse, Standard Chartered, many others, alleging that the money moved by Iran, tens of millions of dollars, to groups that target U.S. troops in Iraq. And they're filing a lawsuit now, which is very important. As you know, other groups have done it. This is the case against Arab Bank that I try to discuss. This is what the flip side of what of their attempts to use lawfare against America, Israel, democracies, threatening always to go to the International Criminal Court, which rejected, by the way, the Mavi Marmara case.
Right, we spoke about that.
The Turkish ship, which we talked about, but it's really significant. We've heard the reverberations just in the last couple of days about it.
Unbelievable. Have you circled January the 6th on your calendar? It seems that will be a significant day in Israeli politics. They're actually going to have the Likud committee elections. Is the prime minister going to win this easily?
Well, that is actually interesting because there's much more talk here than I anticipated about possibilities of elections. I don't think anybody anticipates them very soon, but they are talking about next year. There are people jockeying for positions. There are, a lot of reports. There's stories of people dropping out of government, going into government. I spoke to several of them to see who, what is really happening. So some of them did it really on a personal basis for their own reasons. Some just burn out. But we see Gil Erdan now coming into the government, and Gil Sire went out. And he was slated to become ambassador to the United Nations from Israel. So now that search has to take place and starts again.
So,
and overall, there are increasing tensions, I would say, between parties and within factions.
So the Likud party goes to the polls in January. What's likely that right after the summer there's new elections in Israel?
I would say that in 2015 you'll see an election.
Like somewhere from September to November.
From four or five. Well, it depends also on events,
right?
But people already, the criticisms, the fight between the Shabak and the IDF, these are really unseeming. It should not be tolerated. Certainly not public.
Right.
And
well, that's the reason I bring it up is because I'm not that there's ever a good time for elections in Israel, but I don't know. Now it just seems like this is the wrong time. If anything, we need as much stability as possible, and not what campaigns generally do to Israel.
I would agree, and especially after this summer when we saw such tremendous unity, I don't see any real coalition against Netanyahu. Probably Lieberman will run independently. The question is whether there will be mergers of some of the parties. Will you know, the leadership stay the same in Labor or many of the other parties that, you know, have had primaries, will have primaries, will be discussing, you know, their future role. But yes, none of the polls show the clear victory for anybody. And Bibi still, I think, remains the most popular political leader.
Finally, the New York Times this week described it as a leaderless Palestinian revolt. Now, we know what they mean. You know, there's no address to this type of terrorism, all these random attacks that are unfortunately taking the lives of so many people, or whatever number it is, obviously is significant. Is this different in any way than the leaderless Palestinian revolts, you know, during Intifada I, Intifada II? I know you keep telling us, rightfully so, that the address for this one is the PA and that PA leadership is inciting it, etc. So is it, in fact, a leaderless Palestinian revolt or not?
Well, it's also Hamas, but remember, the Hamas and the PA have a joint regime.
Right.
The leaderless in the sense that there isn't a central core place, somebody giving the orders. But we've certainly seen the pattern of incitement that I mentioned before, and it's the reason I mentioned it, for exactly what you're highlighting. The attacks do not appear to be coordinated, but certainly the message about the vehicular attacks, the message about stabbing, the attacks on the light railroad, which has knocked out a good portion of the cars of it, these are not just spontaneous.
Yeah, but I'm asking from a different angle. In other words, we, you know, who worry constantly about the citizens of Israel, rightfully so. So we saw eventually during the era of bus bombing, Israel was able to secure things to the point where, thank God, you know, that whole thing, you know, essentially it ended. Security was able to be built and be good enough to stop it. Is it possible, if in fact that this is leaderless and random, is it possible for Israeli security to deal with it in an efficient fashion?
I do think so. I've spoken to security people and police and others. I do believe that they're capable of dealing with it. They have to be willing to withstand some of the criticism. There has to be, I think, more foresight in anticipating some of the developments that have occurred, that you can't, you know, once they started attacking the light railroad, if you don't stop it, it's just going to spread, because they know that it, you know, it strikes a chord, and especially when you have violence in around the Harabais, the Temple Mount, and other sensitive areas. But yes, I do believe you can do much more. Can you prevent everything? No. Can you stop, you know, some of the stone throwing to a full degree? No. But arrest the parents when they're kids. Hold people for serious account. The legislation to stop the freeing of prisoners, because look at who carried out the attack, guys. One of them was involved in two prisoner releases. One by Sharoni was released, and one in the Gilad Shalit.
That's right. I forgot to mention that. So important. So important. This is one of the things you always warn about. These guys getting back in the field and spreading terrorism again. And sure enough.
And of course, when we look at the threat from the ISIS guys,
yeah,
who are coming back, and you see the recruitment numbers and the training that's going on, is another thing. You know, Iran can play a role in all of this, but very little holding account for them trying to undermine regimes and stimulating the terrorism, as is ISIS and others. And there has to be, I mean, really strong policies about this if we want to really stop it and stop the danger to citizens everywhere.
I think people in our community are getting more and more tense about these issues. I don't know.
They shouldn't be tense. They have to be alert. They have to make sure our institutions are protected. We have to press our governments to take the steps necessary to watch our borders, to watch to enhance the police capabilities, to see to it that the countries that in which these are taking place take responsibility for what goes on there or pay a price. The you know, these things spread. These are cancers that spread globally and endanger more and more. And the when a country like Russia wants to sell two nuclear reactors, which is not bad because they get paid for it, but they also enrich the uranium, take the spent the rods, and reprocess them in Russia, but they're talking about six more. We're going to be seeing, you know, other countries then rushing into it, the free flow of arms. And then when events like Yemen or what's going on in Lebanon today, and the international community just washes its hands of it, and all the parties that should be there defending the people and the countries that we hear from, who feel themselves under siege and feel that the West completely ignores them.
Yeah, that's
what
true.
What incentive is there then for them to take the risk and to stand up? You know, Samantha Power, Ambassador Power, the U.S. ambassador to UN, pointed out that this OSCE conference on anti-Semitism, about the fact that a third less leaders from Europe even came at a time when you have such a sharp increase in anti-Semitism, and she really laid down the law with about holding them to account for what goes on. This is only one of the symptoms, one of the things. Look how quickly they can arouse the whole international community against Israel for defending its citizens and doing what it should be doing. And yet when it comes to speaking out against some of these BDS campaigns against...
Not a word, right?
Anti-Semitism.
Unbelievable. Malcolm, very quickly, last week you mentioned a whole list of holy sites in different areas of the Middle East, Jewish holy sites that continue to be destroyed or defaced. Is there anybody who's written extensively on this somewhere on the web or anything you could point to that you've seen where people can get a better perspective? Because a lot of the listeners of this show were shocked to hear what you said on that topic last week.
And we saw more of it. And it's, by the way, not just Jewish sites, it's Christian sites.
Right, you had mentioned both, right.
And even Muslim holy sites. You know, the Shiites don't tolerate mausoleums or graves, and they desecrate the...
So is anyone out there?
Sunni sites as well. But there are articles, there are some reports that have been written about the extensive damage. There were some newspaper accounts where they tried to aggregate the incidents of the well-known sites, the sites of the prophets of others that have come under consistent siege. And, you know, the Iranians, by the way, threatened to destroy the graves, the site of the graves of Mordechai and Esther,
right,
and many others. So this is a thing that spreads, and they know that it hurts people.
All right, so it's out there, or as we say in the vernacular now, I guess it's searchable. Don't forget, Wednesday night, Malcolm will be back from Jerusalem. He'll be at the Young Israel of Flatbush with Rabbi Beryl Wine. That starts at 8 p.m. this coming Wednesday evening in Flatbush, Brooklyn. Enjoy Jerusalem, Mr. Honlein, and have a wonderful Shabbos.
I'll think of you all at the Kotel and wish you all a good Shabbos, and pray that it'll be a safe Shabbos, especially being Chai Sarah.
Amen.
In Hebron.
That's right. A lot of people in Hebron, they should have a safe and wonderful time. It is an incredible time there. This Shabbos, I miss it already. JM and the AM Friday morning, Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.